I'm with Mr. C.H. Punch Dickens. He's with the Royal Flying Corps and the RAF, and famous Canadian bush pilot, and later head of CPR. Other things. Today's date is 29 September 1978, and we're going to talk about the RAF and the First War. Before we get into that, Mr. Dickens, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your family background, where you were born, your nursery school, and that type of thing.
Yes, I was born in Portage Prairie, Manitoba, in January 1899, where my father was the manager of the Bank of Ottawa there. And I spent the first 8 years of my life there. When he was transferred to Edmonton, as a new branch of the bank was opened there. And I really lived the next 25 years of my life there, except for the time I was overseas. Went to school and high school and university there. It was while I was at university, and I'd completed my second year in March of 1917, that I decided to enlist. I was 18 years old then, and some of my friends who were slightly older than I was had gone overseas with the 196th University Battalion, mm-hmm. which had later become a reinforcement for the Princess Pats overseas. And I thought that was a pretty good unit, and therefore I decided to enlist and join up with a reinforcing company of the 196th Battalion, with the idea that it would be one that would go primarily to the Princess Pats.
You see a lot. Before this, though, your brother was in as well, is that correct?
Yes, my older brother had enlisted. He was 2 years older than I was, and he had completed his third year at university, and so he had joined up the year before I did, and he had gone overseas with the Canadian infantry, but he had received a commission before he left because he had taken an officer's training course. And actually, I also had taken the officer's training course during the 2 years I was at university.
Well, prior to university, in 14, you were high school, I gather?
Yes.
Doing the matriculation. What was your impression when war broke out and Canada became involved? Do you have any recollection?
Well, yes, I have. I know where I was. I was standing on the shore of Gull Lake, a summer resort, more or less out of Edmonton, about 60 miles south from there, with some friends of mine, and we all wondered what would happen. The war had just been declared, and a number of us, the boys, we'd known each other since through school and so on, and we were wondering. And my brother was at that time going to go to university that year, that fall, and I still had a year to go in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So we just wondered, and we talked, and we felt, and then of course somebody said, well, of course it'll all be over and by Christmas even. And but the thing they forgot about, they didn't say which Christmas, of course.
Yes.
And it was quite exciting, all right, but it didn't really affect my life very much for another year. Then I began seriously thinking about the war going on and continuing and enlisting.
Well, now the pressure you figured would come, say, in late 15, early 16?
Yes, in 16 mainly, because I went to university in 15, started my university course in 1915, and it was towards the end of the first year there, or when I went back, really, at the end of 1916. Quite a few of the fellows that were slightly older than I was weren't there anymore. They joined up and gone. And this began having an impression on me.
Now, while you were at university, you completed an officer's training plan type?
Well, it was an official Canadian officer's training course. Through the university, it was put on by the military, and it was a pretty strict course, as a matter of fact.
Now, when you say course, was it part of the curriculum type thing, or just that you were expected to on evenings, or what?
Yes, really, mainly, you put in additional time to your regular studies, because I was carrying on a combined course of both science and arts at the time, And I had to fit this in, and we used to stay after lectures for sometimes a couple of hours. I'd often wouldn't get home till 6, 7 o'clock in the evening, and sometimes we'd be up and over at the university at 8 o'clock in the morning to get an hour in on lectures, military lectures.
There'd be military lectures. Now, you weren't out route marching and wearing a uniform, or what, or were you, or what?
We to start with, we didn't have uniforms because I think they were scarce. Yeah. But we were taken on route marches. We were given musketry training. We were given books to read and study, and we had to know all the drill right through the piece, right through the book, the drill manual inside out, you might say. They used to stress that. And then you had to be able to give the proper commands to form force, left turn, you know, by the left quick march, and so on, and all this, and get it on the right foot, the right beat, right time. It was good training. I think it was excellent training. And we had a certain amount of study of tactics on the battlefield, which of course didn't envisage the stalemate of the trenches, really. But we had to study maneuvers, and we had to post guards, and we had to do, you might say, scouting and advance reconnaissance, all on the ground, and we'd go out in the field. And of course, with the marching and the drill was done right on the university grounds there.
How did your colleagues at the university feel about you and your other fellows in this program? Did they give you a hard time about it, or were you admired for it? Or
no.
Of course? Or?
No. It was voluntary to take this officer's training course, completely voluntary. And it was voluntary to enlist, you see, too. There was no conscription then, and or anything. And so the ones that volunteered worked at it, and just the same as I took it, sort of as another university course.
Yeah. Would you receive any pay for this?
Not that I remember. I don't remember ever receiving pay for it, no. But when I did enlist, I joined up as a private, just as a buck private in the Army, because my friends at that time were buck privates, and I didn't want to try to be an officer or anything. I was too young anyway, I think.
But you had your certificate.
But I had my certificate that I had successfully completed this course and was qualified to hold a commission. This stood me in good stead later when I joined the Flying Corps.
Well, now 17 comes around, you're 18 years old, 1917's around, and we had, I guess, the first real strong bit about conscription in Canada. Was there any coercion placed on you or your colleagues, do you know, to enlist at all?
I don't think so, certainly not on me, personally, and I didn't feel any of the effects of it or any of the questionable things about it at all. I wanted to enlist when I was 18 and felt that I should. And it was mainly because of, I think, my friends and associates and people and my brother and my parents, and I told them I was going to enlist.
And how did they react?
They were wonderful. My mother was, of course, a little upset, but she said, if you feel you have to, you go ahead. And my father the same.
Now, you enlisted where? Now, you enlisted right at the
University? Right at the University, I did, yes. And they sent me down to the armories, and I had a medical inspection and all the things and questions and answers and filled in all
the
forms.
Which armories
would this be? Well, I think they were the armories on 102nd Avenue near 106th Street in Edmonton, where the 19th Alberta Dragoons used to use it as an armory and as a base there. They had a militia unit there.
You said before that you wanted a connection with the PPCLI, but that was to come overseas, not
well,
to go
this,
down? Or
no, you see, this company, this reinforcing company, C Company, of the 196th Battalion, University Battalion, was being formed at the University of Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
And the captain, who was to take the company overseas, you might say, I suppose he was really doing a little recruiting, but he had been one of the instructors on this COTC course, and we all knew him,
mm-hmm.
and we told him we wanted to enlist, about six of us. And so he said, fine, come on up and we'll begin to get things ready. And so we went to his office at the university, and he took us all in and talked to us and so on and showed us what was necessary. Then he made arrangements for us to go and have the official medical examinations and fill in all the other papers and be sworn in. But we were then in the 190 C Company, 196th University Battalion, which we felt, we all thought, was going to be the reinforcing unit, or one of the reinforcing units for the PPCLI.
Yep. So you're going in the back door as opposed to...
That's right. Because there wasn't any recruiting direct for the PPCLI then in Edmonton that I know of.
Calgary type, I guess.
I think, yes.
Victoria,
you see, the Edmonton regiment was the 49th Battalion, and they were already overseas, and they were recruiting reinforcing companies. But I don't know, my friends and myself, we opted for the University Battalion. And
now, did you have any concern about the flying corps at this point, or was it strictly to get in uniform?
Well, by this time, my brother had written to say that he had been seconded to the Royal Flying Corps as an officer, and that he was flying as an observer with number 12 Squadron in France, and that things were going along all right. He told us as much as he could in letters and so on. So that was a contact for me, and I began thinking about it then. And then when I got overseas to England and I could see airplanes in the air a lot more than I'd ever seen in Canada, realized the amount of activity, I also found out that the Royal Flying Corps were looking for people. They were interested in you if you had a desire to join. And a lot of the younger fellows, English chaps, coming out of school in the same age group I was in, were joining up directly with the Royal Flying Corps. And if they qualified, provided they eventually got their wings, they were given commissions. And if they didn't qualify, they became a sergeant pilot. They were promoted to sergeant and became a pilot. But we were all cadets in training together, you might say, when we took the ground school course at Oxford University,
mm-hmm.
Christchurch in Oxford. Yes, we're our little heads or something.
Well, now, you joined up, you got all your paperwork done. Where were you first sent then? You were down to the armory down in Edmonton?
Yes, and then...
And then what, March 17th?
This would be in March, that's right.
March 17th.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, then were you sent like Camp Borden or...
No. No.
Wasn't Camp Borden there?
No. We were, it was, I think, a military base, yeah, same as Valcarce and so on, sure, but actually while they were recruiting and coming up to strength,
mm-hmm.
We were based in Edmonton. And then I was sent, along with another chap, on a course to Winnipeg from the unit, and there were a class of about 30 or 35, I guess, from various units across Western Canada that were sent on a physical training course at the North End YMCA in Winnipeg. And we were quartered in the YMCA, and then we went to the armory every day up in the North End of Winnipeg and took this training for about 4 weeks. And so I became a physical training instructor. I qualified for that, and then we had a part of a bayonet fighting course too, military drill and rifle drill and bayonet fighting. So that was an interesting experience too. Well, I came back then to Edmonton, and by that time the company was pretty well filled up, and it wasn't very long after that we joined up on a troop train. We were sent to Calgary and joined up on a troop train with some units from the 151st Battalion, I think it was, Calgary,
mm-hmm.
and then started off the long trek across Canada to Halifax.
What about uniforms and things like this?
No, well, we were issued uniforms about 2 days after we enlisted. we got uniforms right away, just private uniforms and boots and so on, yes, and equipment. We weren't issued rifles at that time. We used to go and do rifle drill and then put the rifles back in the armory.
Did you do the Ross rifle?
Or? Yeah.
What's the Ross rifle?
We did all our drills with Ross rifles to start with. Then when we got overseas, we found we were using the Lee Enfield, the British Lee Enfield.
Well, the scandal of the Ross, I guess, hadn't hit by this point, or had
it? Well, I guess it did. It was the fact that the rifle, I think, wasn't it, the open bolt mechanism.
Jamming up?
Yes, with any grit, sand, or dirt, and the mud and stuff you see, if you flop down and it happened to scrape up a little dirt, the thing wouldn't go home, wouldn't ram home.
Mm-hmm.
And they got some blowbacks and fellas got hit in the face and in the eye. And the Lee Enfield was the standard rifle when I was in England anyway, because I remember firing it on the musketry course that I had
mm-hmm.
when I was at the reserve unit, reserve Italian unit.
How were you treated in uniform? Did you notice a distinct change from people?
No, not a distinct change, I don't think. Matter of fact, I was pretty busy, and I didn't have too much time to... No, and I don't think the uniform mattered very much to people. Not to my friends or the people that mm-hmm. I knew, anyway. No, I don't think it did.
What about the barracks and barrack conditions?
Well, they were... reasonable, I guess. We just slept on a mattress, not a very big one, of course, on some loose boards, and you could put the whole thing away and stow it away, you know, and clean up the floor, and that was it. And a couple of blankets, the pillow. We didn't have any sheets, and
you had a cord head sheet.
Well, I know. No, we didn't. Matter of fact, we didn't.
You didn't have sheets in the flying
corps
either, eh?
No, we sure didn't.
Just a mess.
Yeah. Even at Oxford, when we were taking our ground school courses, we didn't.
No. Well, you got on this train then in, what are we talking now, summer of 17?
Yes. And it went clean across Canada. I think it took us 6 days and six nights. Get from Calgary to Halifax.
Were you impressed with the...
Well, it was quite a journey. All right. And we got off the train at two or three places. I can't remember just where. And I had a bit of a route march. A couple of miles of walking and get some exercise and fresh air. And I guess while they refitted the train and got restocked with provisions and water and stuff. And then at other places you could get off for half an hour and just go on your own up and down. Of course, there'd be a great swarm of fellows pile out of the train and then pile back in again. But it was very interesting. And when we got to Halifax, we were taken in smaller launches, I call them, or I suppose they'd call them pilot boats or tenders, to the... Mauritania.
So this is right off the train?
Right off the train.
No stay at static or no nothing?
Nope. We were right off the train and onto the ship. Yeah. And we were about the second or the third troops on board, and they started loading it from the lowest deck up. So we were way down in the bottom. Just about over the engine room. And no portholes or anything. And hammocks. Nothing but hammocks. And we had to... just packed in there as tight as you could get. And I think they eventually put close to 8,000 troops on that ship, which had carried about, 1,000 passengers normally. But every space was hung with hammocks. And
that you had your commission at this point.
Well, I began to think about it, but the other fellows were there too, so we were all together and had to make the best of it. And the funny part of it was that we didn't move. The ship didn't move. It lay at anchor there in the harbor for about 6 days while it was still being loaded, you see, and
you
so
were down
on.
The hole.
Well, no, we'd get up on deck every day and so on and roam around. And, of course, we finally, Palomine and I, we finally found a little hangout up on one of the decks, way at the back of the stern of the ship, and shelter and pretty good up there. And so you went to a certain mess places with your mess kit, your mess tin and stuff, and they gave you your stuff, and we'd take it back up and go back to this little nook we found up on the stern of the boat. And the rest of the fellows, they just wandered back down to where we were sleeping and everything, and it was pretty miserable, really. And we liked the fresh air and the so on. And we did that even when we were steaming and underway. Well, then the ship was fast enough. We thought we were all waiting for a convoy, but we weren't. We went over practically alone, but the ship changed course every so 90 minutes, and it didn't stay very long on any one course, and it was going, I guess, full speed practically all the way, because in 5 days we were in England. Once we left Halifax Harbor.
It took longer to load than to get there.
And we were met by a couple of destroyers about 3 days out, destroyer on each side.
Mm-hmm.
But that boat just kept going pretty well full bore all the way.
Much concern over you both times.
Oh yes, you bet.
Were you started in the ship's drill?
Oh yes, we had life-saving stations and so on, and we had them every day. Every day you had a drill on the way over, except some of those were so sick, seasick.
I guess seasickness would be a major problem.
Well, it was, because of the confined quarters and lack of ventilation and so on, and also at night, practically no lights. They had all the portholes blanked out naturally, mm-hmm. and the ship, every window was blacked out all over the ship, so that no lights were showing at all. And I guess they maintained radio silence pretty well, too, all the way.
Hmm. Well, when you got to England, where did you go? Did you go to Southampton?
Well, we docked at Southampton. And, no, we docked in Liverpool.
Liverpool.
Yeah, docked at Liverpool. And we got on trains again and reversed the process, and we ended up at Bramshot Camp in England, where the 21st Reserve Battalion, Canadian Army, had a big reserve base there, and we were, for administrative and other purposes, put in the 21st Battalion.
What were the conditions like in England then?
Well, they were pretty good. They had long wooden huts, I suppose about 50 in each hut, and we had to keep the place clean and tidy as well, and we just had these mattresses practically on the floor again to sleep on, but it wasn't too bad. But they had a big mess hall there. This was rather good.
Mm-hmm.
You went in the mess hall for your meals and so on, and they had a nice canteen where you could buy things and so forth. It was quite different. And the people around there were very, very, very nice to us. We found some wonderful walks through the countryside. It's very beautiful around there, around Guildford and mm-hmm. in through there. And occasionally somebody would ask you to come and have tea with them on a Sunday or something, and you'd apply for a pass and go and have tea with an English family. It was very pleasant. And we had long route marches too from there, getting into physical shape. And we did a lot of work out on the rifle ranges. And we had to march out to the rifle ranges and back every day and take an intermediate lunch with us. And I think it was about, it'd be at least 3 or 4 miles each way to the rifle ranges. So you were doing 6 to 7 miles a day marching, plus all the running around on the rifle range. And that was interesting, too. It was all very interesting. I kind of enjoyed that part of it.
You had no particular ambition at this point, though, to get your commission, or?
Not to take my commission. I was thinking more and more about, would I or wouldn't I apply for the Flying Corps? And I met my brother on leave. He had some leave from France, and he came back, and I met him in London. I got 2 days off and went up to London, and we talked things over, and he said that he was only going to be a short time before he would be able to get leave and come back to England and take training as a pilot, because he'd put in enough time as an observer.
Mm-hmm.
And so this interested me, and he told me a lot about flying and things and so on, and so I decided that I'd go ahead with it. And by this time I was getting a little bored around the reserve battalion, because we had taken all these courses, and now we were just sort of in a state of suspension, waiting, and we were doing other jobs like repairing buildings and tarring roofs and doing a certain amount of repair work around the place and so on. And
it's important.
And I thought, well, this wasn't exactly what I thought it was going to be. It was no hardship, really, but it just didn't carry quite the interest. So I decided one day, and I went to the orderly room, and I asked the captain there, and he said, yes, I can have the forms. And I took the forms away, and I filled them all in, and I brought them back and presented them to him. And he said, yes, they appear to be in order. And he talked to me for a while, and I guess he knew that I really wanted to do it, and so to transfer. And so he passed them on to the commanding officer, and the commanding officer didn't have any particular remarks, and he put them on to brigade headquarters. Well, it turned out that at brigade headquarters, there was an officer by the name of Brigadier General Meehan. And I didn't know this at the time, but one day I got a notice to parade. Mm-hmm. Captain sent for me and told me to spruce up and get ready, and that I was to go to brigade headquarters. And he sent me over to brigade headquarters with a motorcycle and a sidecar, and I was paraded before the Brigadier General. And he had my application in front of him, along with two or three others, incidentally. But he started talking to me and asking me a few questions, and particularly about Forest La Prairie, where I'd been born. So it turned out, as he told me a little later, that he had been a great friend of my father's.
Mm.
And that he was the manager of the Maple Leaf Milling Company that had a flour mill in Forest La Prairie. And that we as boys used to go down and skate on the pond for the cooling water from the boilers and in the wintertime. And so he remembered all this.
Mm.
and said that he would recommend my application. And during the course of our conversation, I had brought up the fact, too, that I had taken the officer's training course during my 2 years at university. And he said, Have you got the certificate? And I said, not with me, sir, no, but I have it. And he said, well, will you send it to me? And so I sent it to him. And I think this made a bit of a difference with the Flying Corps, because I was told a few days later that my application had been accepted, and that if I qualified, I would be eligible for a commission in the Royal Flying Corps. But I had to be discharged from the
and
Canadian
you
Army.
You weren't going to use the condit now, because you didn't have a commission.
No, I didn't have a commission. I was still just a private. And so they couldn't accept seconding or anything. So I was discharged. I was sent up to London to the Canadian Army discharge. They had a discharge depot up there, number 2, I think it was. And I was in a room, and I received my final medical examination, and checked out that everything was in order, and I was discharged in this room, and I was led by an orderly into another room right next door, where a British officer was sitting at a desk and had papers all ready for me. So I think it was a matter of between 5 and 10 minutes from the time I was discharged from the Canadian Army until I was re-enlisted in the British Army.
Well, with that discharge, you could have just gone home, I guess, isn't it?
Well, I suppose officially or technically I could have, but I think I'd have been arrested if I had.
This fellow wasn't going to let you out of his sight, is
he? I wouldn't think so, no. But by that time, I was interested in getting into the Flying Corps and I wanted to go. Sure.
Now, you went into the other room, basically, And then we were met by a British officer in the Royal Flying Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And then you signed their forms and their papers.
Yeah.
And we're joining the British forces as opposed to the Canadian.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, the pay difference, did you know?
Yes. I was given British rates of pay, which were substantially lower than the Canadian rates of pay. But that, again, didn't matter to me. I wasn't worried about the pay too much. And it didn't matter to me very much either whether I was an officer or not. But it was nice, of course. But I wanted to get flying. So I was posted right away to a unit down at Hastings on the south coast, where they gave us about 2 weeks of drill instruction and rifle handling and so on, part of the Army training course. And of course, this was old stuff to the Canadians. We'd all been through it. But the young British fellows who were coming into the flying corps hadn't. They hadn't had this training either in the Army before or at school. And so it was queer, but most of the cadet officers in the units then, I was promoted to corporal almost overnight and put in charge of a platoon of these fellows, a squad of about 12 of them, to teach them the rifle drill, which end of the rifle went off and which didn't, and how to handle it, and how to take it apart and put it together again, and to shoot it, and so on, how to aim it.
So you're back where you started.
Yeah, and then how to, you know, slope arms and trail arms and present arms and so on. And I was almost back where it started, but at least I was a corporal. And things went on from there. Some of the older fellows were made sergeants and so on, and we had a warrant officer from there who was very good, very strict fellow and sharp, but if you did your stuff, there was nothing he wouldn't do for you. He would always say, you better take day's leave or something, and, you know, go and see the sights around here or something like this and so forth, and no problems at all. If you were on parade and if you carried out your instructions and paid attention.
Now, would you have the maternity jacket type thing?
No, not yet. We were still in our Canadian private uniforms, as a matter of fact.
Alright.
Now, when we finished that course, we got split up there a little bit, but two of the Canadians and myself were posted to the School of Aeronautics, as it was called, Ground School of Aeronautics, at Oxford, Christ Church College in Oxford. We were given a few days leave in London in between, and then we went to Oxford. And this was where we began to get lectures on the theory of flight, on navigation, on map reading, on a number and variety of things, and even on aerial fighting such as they had. And the training also we had in the drill was good. We didn't have rifles there, but we had an awful lot of drill on that parade square, about the big square there at Christ Church College. And we had a sergeant major there who was really a martinet. He was a tough one. And, God, you just get out a step or something, and he could spot it amongst 200 people. He could spot the one that was out of step, you know. Anyway, we got by that pretty well, too, because we'd had all this, the Canadians, and we began to be able to...
Who were the other Canadians with you?
Well...
Do you recall their names?
Well, there was a fellow named Anderson from Calgary, and there was a fellow named Grant, and that followed through into the Flying Corps. There were other friends of mine who stayed with the infantry, but these fellows were with me into the Flying Corps, and... they were at Oxford. We were both at Hastings and then at Oxford together.
Were you treated as a colonial at all? Or
no, we weren't really. No. I must say these warrant officers, these sergeant majors that we ran across, who were the strict disciplinarians, they didn't give us the lectures, but they took us on these marching and drill and all the military configurations that they could think of. They were pretty strict, but they were fair, and it was good. It was good training, because the touch had to be there on time, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
There was no excuse for being late for parade whatsoever. None whatever. Stay up all night then if you have to. You be here. And it was 10 minutes to 7, not 7 o'clock either. You'd better be out there and ready. Well, this was no great hardship either, because we'd become accustomed to it. Sure. Our infantry training had taught us all that.
How do you compare the Canadian versus the British? I mean, I know there are Canadians writing British manuals, but was there subtle differences at all?
No, I think that by virtue of our previous training, we had an advantage over the English fellows who came into the service right straight out of school and hadn't had any real military training at all. Some of them did have big trouble trying to get their left foot and their right coordinated and trying to get the rifle drill down, even to just get a pass on it.
Yeah.
Because they weren't accustomed to it. But they were a pretty good bunch of fellows. I made some very good friends later, some English chaps, and we were all of an age group, you see, practically all of us just in our teens, 18, 19, 19 or 20. If you were 20 or 21, you were an old fellow, almost. And some of the British fellows were about 17. But anyway, the whole thing was looking back on it now, was a pretty good experience. And I didn't find any discrimination or any favoritism at any time.
What about your courses at all, like your theory of flight courses and things? I know flight was a very difficult subject and very new, and a lot of things weren't known, but looking back now after your years of experience flying, was your instruction good at the time?
I think it was. I really think it was, for those who understood it and who listened and paid attention. Because later, when you got to actually flying, if you remembered that the airflow had to go over those wings at a certain speed to sustain the weight of the airplane,
mm-hmm.
and that to make it climb, that the lifting force had to be greater than the force of gravity, and you had also to overcome the drag of this air, that you were the drag of the plane through the air, it all added up. So if you applied what you had heard and listened to and were taught, when you did become airborne, you soon realized that it was a basic principle, really, that they were teaching you. They couldn't teach you exactly how to handle the airplane, but they could teach you the basic principles of what made the airplane fly. And this, to my mind, was excellent. And they had pretty good navigation, and we had good cracks at map reading and so on.
Mm-hmm.
All on, you know, theoretical on the ground, but it all helped when you did get up in the air.
Did you have much time off your leave and things like that?
No, not a great deal. I think that Christmas. It was just about changeover, yes. I was posted just at the 1st of January, 1918. I was posted to the 25th Training Squadron in the RFC, where I actually mm-hmm. started to fly. And they gave me a week. I had Christmas, and I had New Year's Day, and then I had a report the next day up at the Thetford in Norfolk, which I did.
What about entertainment and that type of thing? Was there much entertainment for Navy soldiers over there?
No, I can't say there was. I don't remember very much in the way of entertainment. We had to get passes to go out in the evenings at Oxford, when we were at Oxford there. Otherwise, you were supposed to be in barracks after your supper in the evening. And we had to get passes to, if we wanted to go to a movie, a picture show, or the cinema, as they say,
mm-hmm.
You had to get a pass, because you'd be out too late coming back to get in the gate.
How did it feel to be at Oxford now? You had been at university before. before? Well, have the
it was when you saw the surroundings and got to realize the place, I was thrilled by it. I really was. I was thrilled by it. Oh, yes. That the great mess hall there in the Christ Church College, and when you realize the people that had sat at these long refectory tables with just benches, you know, and looked at the beams in the ceiling and the place itself. It was impressive to me, anyway. Very impressive. Yes, I liked that part of it at Oxford, indeed. And it was very nice. On the river there is a beautiful prospect, really. And the people were kind again, too. We didn't get out as much there as we did at Hastings. It wasn't quite as free and easy. We were supposed to study more and to do more work and get down to it.
Now, you left and you said to go to Norfolk to the...
Yes, this is the flying training station.
Flying training station, this would be January...
Yes, January 1918, yeah.
Now, you wouldn't have received your wings rating.
Well, no, I was a provisional pilot officer then, and had been issued a new uniform with the maternity jacket and the fore and aft cap with a white band on it. That was your
RFC pin also?
No.
No pin?
Nope. He just had a, well, it had an RFC badge, yes, on the cap, yes, mm-hmm. The round circular badge, yeah. And and I'd gotten a uniform allowance to enable me to buy this uniform. That came about after you were qualified at Oxford. And of course they told you beforehand to go get your outfit and so on. So I
no cuffs on the pants?
No. Oh no, and I had brakes. I had brakes and high boots.
You were allowed to be
or putties. Yeah, we were more or less could use cavalry style stuff, all except the spurs. They wouldn't let us use spurs.
You feel very invincible, or?
Oh no, no, not a bit. No, there were hundreds more like you, so no. It didn't.
Didn't make
much difference. No, really didn't.
Okay. Well, now you're already flying. I know in the RC you either flew to start like 5 hours figured out, or you're on your rear. Now what was it like?
Well, I guess that was something that may have happened. I don't know. I was never told that.
Mm-hmm.
But I started flying on a rather ancient airplane called a Morris Farman, which was invented in about 1914, I think, put out by the well-known French aviator Morris Farman and his brother Henry Farman. And it had a lot of bamboo and piano wire and a small pusher engine. You sat in a little cockpit out in the front. The engine was behind you. But I think it was within the first month that I was there. I did very little on them. I might have flown those airplanes for 6 or 7 hours. Then we got a de Havilland 6, which was the new basic trainer for the Flying Corps, and it was a fore and aft, a two-seater biplane, of course, with the engine up front. And then I got onto some what was called a BE-2C, which was also an earlier model, but it had the engine up front, and the RE-8, which is the one that my brother had been working with in France. It was a two-seater with an observer behind and a pilot up front, and so I flew all those types and did most of my actual training, I guess, on the DH-6. And then I got on to flying solo. I was flying VEs and DH-6s and the RE-8s, the DH-4s, the DH-9s came along, and just they'd take you on a familiarization flight, show you the how the petrol turned on and how the throttle worked, and
practice low force landings?
What to look for, yes. Practice landings was the greatest thing, because that was one of your tests. You had to make a minimum, I think it was, of six, as they were called in those days, tail down landings. Because you see, you didn't have tricycle undercarriages. We had a tail skid that dragged on the ground, and this was the idea of getting the tail down was so that it would stop you, because you didn't have brakes either. No, no brakes.
What about the strapping restraints, pronunciation, things like that?
Well, they gave you a certain amount of what they called aerial maneuvers, and I suppose you'd call it aerial fighting practice, but it was mainly steep turns, half rolls, diving, and how to get out of unusual attitudes if you got into a bad attitude, and Immelmann turns, which was to pull right up to a stall and then kick it around and come back on a 180-degree track right from the top of the stall, staying right side up, instead of going over on your back and going down that way and a half roll and then diving out of that. But all these were just maneuvers that you could use if you were caught in...
Imagine a lot of people lose their breakfast doing that.
Well, some of them did, yes, and therefore it didn't pay off. And we were given, though, firing later. We were sent to another place, an aerial gunnery school, for 2 weeks to actual firing of targets. We had cameras on the airplanes that you could dive on a target and take pictures. You could imitate you were firing. And it actually had a little device that made a noise as though you were firing a gun. And then they'd show you the pictures of you, whether you'd hit or not, or what you'd done. Then we also had camera work taking pictures of ground targets.
Mm-hmm.
I had to fly over a pinpoint, and you had the cameras mounted right beside you here, and you pulled the lever like this and shoved the plate in and out, and you pushed the button and took the picture. And then you changed the plate again, and then when you got over the other one, you see, and you had to look over the side of the airplane to see where you were going for sure, to be right over it. This was practice for later, for bomb aiming and for actually taking reconnaissance pictures.
Hey, you weren't in this very long though, are you?
No.
You don't have that many hours.
No.
Preparation.
No, no. The minimum for getting your wings at the time I was there was 20 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I had somewhere, I think, around 24 to 25 hours total when at the end of my course, and I was sent to France.
With your wings, though.
But I qualified and got my wings and was gazetted into the service as a pilot officer, or second lieutenant, really, I was. The pilot officer didn't.